Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Margot True, food editor of Sunset Magazine, lead author of The One Block Feast, and your moderator for today's program. Find the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org or download the club's iPhone and Android app for program information and to reserve tickets for upcoming events. This program is part of the club's Food Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. It's also being held in association with the Commonwealth Club's Bay Gourmet Forum. Tonight, we'll focus on the California food revolution and the impact of California cuisine on how we all eat, not just in this state, but throughout the United States. Our food scene has changed drastically since the 1970s, with terms like farm-to-table, organic, and fusion all entering the national vocabulary, and local fresh seasonal food on home and restaurant tables nearly everywhere, and ingredients like fresh goat cheese and mesclun widely available. We all take this for granted now. It was not always the case, as you'll find out. You're about to meet some of California's top chefs and thinkers about food who will discuss how food has evolved over the past 30-plus years, and they'll also discuss their own contributions to the development of California cuisine. Let me briefly introduce our distinguished speakers. Joyce Goldstein has received the James Beard Award for Best Chef in California and the Lifetime Achievement Award from Women Chefs and Restaurateurs. She was chef and owner of the groundbreaking restaurant Square One in San Francisco, which she ran from 1984 to 1996. She is also the author of 26 cookbooks, and her writing appears in the San Francisco Chronicle, the Sommelier Journal, Fine Cooking, and many other publications. Her new book, Inside the California Food Revolution, also serves as the basis for tonight's discussion. Annie Somerville has been executive chef of Green's Restaurant in San Francisco since 1985. She is highly regarded for her imaginative approach to vegetarian cooking, and has always stressed a commitment to using farm-fresh produce and cooking with the seasons. Born in Michigan, she moved with her family to Southern California when she was young and later attended college at Humboldt State. Annie is a popular teacher of cooking classes as well as the author of several books, including Everyday Greens. Murad Lalou is the chef and owner of Aziza in San Francisco. He came to the Bay Area when he was 18 to study economics, and missing his native cuisine, he taught himself how to recreate his favorite Moroccan dishes using local California ingredients. Today, his modern reinventions of traditional Moroccan cooking showcase the great flavors of his native cuisine in ways that harmonize with the fresh artisanal ingredients of Northern California. In 2008, Murad was named a Rising Star Chef by Star Chefs Magazine, and in 2009, Zagat named Aziza one of the top 10 Bay Area restaurants of the decade. That same year, Lalou won Food Network's Iron Chef America by a record-breaking margin. And in 2010, Aziza became the first Moroccan restaurant ever to receive a Michelin star, which it retained for the three subsequent years. And then last year, 2012, Murad was named a culinary ambassador by Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton as part of an American Chef Corps program to promote U.S. cooking and agricultural products abroad. And his debut cookbook, Murad New Moroccan, was published in the fall of 2001. And Sue Conley is the co-founder of Cowgirl Creamery, a nationally known company that produces, distributes, and retails artisan and farmstead cheese. Sue moved to San Francisco in 1976 and before long made her way into the kitchen at the Hotel Obrero in Chinatown and later at 4th Street Grill in Berkeley under Paul Bertoli. That's where she met Betty Kronig, the namesake of their joint venture, Betty's Ocean View Diner. After 11 years at the diner, Sue moved to Point Reyes and became a part of a growing dairy and organic farm community there. Sue's dear friend Peggy Smith, a longtime chef at Chez Panisse, decided to join in these efforts in 1997, and together they started making and selling cheese in a renovated hay barn in downtown Point Reyes Station. The story of their cheese-making journey, with delicious recipes, is the subject of their new book, Cowgirl Creamery Cooks, which will be out in October. Please join me in welcoming our extraordinary panel. You've each been chosen for this panel because of the particular role you've played in shaping California's revolutionary cooking and food culture. Could you each take just a few minutes to tell us how you came to be involved in food here and how you view yourself as part of California cuisine? Joyce, would you like to begin?
Well, I will start. I moved here in 1960, having been living in Rome, and missing all the fresh produce. I lived across the street from a huge open market, and I would shop every day because we had no refrigerator. And then I came here, and the produce at our markets was sort of commodity produce. It was all the same stuff, no matter what market you went to. And there were ingredients that I missed, that I got used to cooking with, that were not available. Through serendipity and a teenage son, getting a job as a busboy at Chez Panisse, I ended up filling in for Steve Sullivan, who was taking vacation. He was the baker, and I came in as a temp to cook for about 6 or 8 weeks, and they asked me not to leave. So I stayed and was working with Peggy and actually knew Sue and Betty. Betty Kronig took cooking classes for me in the Stone Age when I started teaching. But slowly but surely, the ingredients started getting better because the chefs were asking for them and because an amazing project had started called the Farm to Restaurant Project, where 6 restaurants each put in $600, and Sibella Krause went out in her car and found farmers to grow things for the restaurants. And eventually Greenleaf set up a distribution system so that we could get it delivered to our restaurants. So all of a sudden the change started happening. And I'm so excited to have been there in the beginning, cooking at Chez Panisse and then at Square One, and watching the changes, which have been amazing, not only in produce, but when you put an open kitchen in a restaurant, it's not a hushed, quiet place where people have to whisper. They can relax and have a good time. The cooks see the diners. We all get to know each other. It's a much more warm and friendly environment. And it had effects in every way. Our menu started to change every day instead of once a year or twice a year. And once that happens, the waiters have to be smarter. You have to tell them what farm something came from and where the fish came from. So slowly but surely, the diners in the Bay Area got really smart and well-informed and kept us on our toes. And now, you know, you say fresh, local, seasonal, and everybody sort of rolls their eyes. It's like, yeah, we've heard that one before. But in 1970, if you said fresh, local, seasonal, you'd be up a creek because there was nothing here. So I've asked some of these people to be on the panel because we've all known each other forever. I've interviewed them for this book. They're wonderful, and I'm proud to know them, and I'm glad they're here.
Annie.
Well, I'll say that I entered Greens through a side door, and Greens is owned by the San Francisco Zen Center, which in the earlier days we knew it as the Zen Center. And Zen Center opened Greens in 1979, and really that idea to open a restaurant, a vegetarian restaurant in 1979, came from the cooking that we did for our guests at Tassajara, which is Zen Center's monastery. And in the summer, it's a hot springs resort and monastery. And it came out of the success of baking bread, cooking three vegetarian meals a day, served family style in a very beautiful, wonderful place. And at that time, the Zen Center was really looking for ways. It was a very young organization, and it was looking for ways to support itself. And also, students at Zen Center were very much wanting to be part of the Zen Center community, not only in practicing meditation, but also to work and to be part of the community, to make work part of their Zen practice. And so the answer was to open a number of businesses. Greens was one of them. And we just had the very good fortune to open in Fort Mason in 1979, at a time when Fort Mason Center, or what's now called Fort Mason Center, Fort Mason was a nonprofit center for the arts, the education, and the environment. And we were to be the restaurant. And then I had also the opportunity to, at that time, Deborah Madison, our founding chef, opened the restaurant with a very large group of Zen students who had absolutely no idea about running a restaurant. In fact, I'll say that there was one person on staff who was the brother of a Zen student who had worked in a restaurant. So it was a big experiment. And then we just happened to, I came to Greens in 1981. We just happened to just, it was just a perfect time. You know, it was also the spirit of the Zen Center was very experimental, trying. I mean, this was all very new, just in the way that Margot was saying. I mean, goat cheese, mesclun, organic, local, seasonal. People didn't know what Zen was then, or very few people did. So we just had the opportunity to participate in the sort of the burgeoning of the whole food, new food movement of being closely connected to our farmers, our producers, our wineries, our cheesemakers, and it's been a pretty great adventure.
Thank you. Murad?
First of all, it's really great to be here. I've never spoken before an audience with such a high IQ. So before we came in here, I know it was Joyce's idea to bring me onto this panel, but I didn't think it was a good idea, because every time we get together and we talk, you know, there's an avalanche of F-bombs. And we said that it's not going to happen tonight, so we have a little bet that it's not going to happen tonight.
It's going to be good.
So it's great to be here. I really came into this business by accident. I came in from Morocco. I had no idea I was going to cook. I never cooked in Morocco. As a matter of fact, if I had told my family that I was going to come to the States to cook, I would have never left. I came here to be somebody important. You know, a doctor or an architect or a lawyer. We settled on a banker. So I went to school for economics. I got a degree. But during that period of time that I was going to college, that's when I realized that the role that food played in my life was a lot more than just fuel. It wasn't just food to get me through the day and give me energy to go to school and play soccer and all those things. When I came here, I feel like I was uprooted from my life. And when I first started, you know, seeing people in their cars eating sandwiches, I thought that was so awful. You know, drinking a cup of coffee while you're driving to work, it's like, what is wrong with you? You know, I don't want to be here. And that was the time when I realized that food was a lot more important than I thought. And it became really obvious to me that it was the glue that kept my family together. It was the thing that literally, you know, kept all of us sane. We argued all the time. We had, you know, fights. We would disagree on everything. But the time to eat, everybody would be quiet and happy and not argue. And I never realized that until I came here. So during the time that I was going to college, I had absolutely no experience in cooking. I never cooked an egg in my life. I never boiled water. But I started calling my family the first couple of months, and then the phone bill was really outrageous. So I had to find a way to reconnect with my base. And the only way to do that was to learn how to cook. And I would sit there and would remember all the moments, because I was too embarrassed to call them and say, how do you make this or how do you make that? So I would sit there and recollect how they made it. you know, they put the onions first, then they added the tomatoes. Of course I was wrong, but I was just, you know, I was playing. So during those 4 or 5 years that I was going to college, basically I taught myself how to cook, and I realized the importance of cooking and food. And when I got my master's degree, I had this crazy idea of opening a restaurant. And I think the best thing that happened was I had no idea what I was doing. If I did, I don't think I would have opened the restaurant. So we opened the restaurant. We had $3,700 to our name. And right now, I mean, I signed the lease, and literally I did not have money for the deposit for the lease. But I had no idea, and it was great because I didn't worry. We opened, and 4 weeks later, Michael Bauer came in. The manager comes up to me, and he goes, "Michael Bauer's in the house." Like, who the hell is Michael Bauer? I don't know, Michael. What is he supposed to do? I mean, what's the point? So, yeah, I became part of this culture, and I, you know, I started making traditional Moroccan food initially, but I felt like it was taken out of context because I felt like food has to have a sense of place. So to basically just make Moroccan food in the middle of the Bay Area was a lie. It was not something that was feasible. If you want Moroccan food, you need to go to Morocco. And even then, you will have so many different versions of Moroccan food. So I felt like I needed to adapt to how people eat in the Bay Area. We had all these ingredients. We had all these techniques. So I felt like to be true to what I was doing, I had to adapt to that and embrace it rather than push it away and just say, I'm going to make Moroccan food the way we eat it in Morocco, because I had no idea what that meant. And eventually we became, you know, a restaurant that's been relevant in this food revolution that is taking place in California.
Thank you, Murad.
I'm glad to hear that story because I think it's so interesting that somebody who majors in economics would open a restaurant.
It didn't help me. Believe me, no. It didn't help me.
No. Wouldn't.
Sue Conley. Go ahead.
I did cook in restaurants in college in Tennessee to make money for my tuition. And it wasn't a profession that I was aspiring to take on. I was a political science major. And then after just traveling about the U.S., landing in San Francisco, I took a job with this Obrero Hotel, which was a Basque restaurant. And the owner of that place had 300 cookbooks. And I thought, wow, I've only ever seen the joy of cooking. That's really great. So, and she had been, she had traveled throughout Europe and lived in Germany and Italy and France. And the people who came to the hotel were from Europe. So, of course, I couldn't wait to get to Europe. And this is one of the themes of Joyce's book, is that we all got to go see what really good cooking. I didn't get to Morocco. That would have been great. But to see what spices and fresh food and, you know, great cheese was. Then I, you know, took cooking seriously, went to City College, hotel and restaurant school, and just learned what a hotel pan was and, you know, how to turn on the stove and manage somewhat. And that's when I met Betty. And we decided with her husband Manfred to open this little diner. And it was 1982, so this food revolution was underway with the farmers markets getting going, Chez Panisse getting going, Jeremiah Tower had his influence. And we decided we would make the diner format because all of those restaurants were too expensive, and we wanted to use those same ethics and make affordable everyday food, which we did. The jockeys came there from Golden Gate Fields, and the contractors and the professors from Cal, and, you know, people who worked in the neighborhood. And it's still going, so you must go there if you haven't been. It's 30 years old. So when I moved to Point Reyes and met the Strauss family, that was really what turned my attention to cheese making, because from the trips to Europe, the questions that the cheese shop owners asked were very different from the ones that I was used to thinking about. It was about what the cows were eating, what the breed of the animal was, what the altitude of the pasture was. These are the questions they asked. It wasn't about the style of cheese that the cheesemaker was trying to achieve. And I realized that in our own community, we had multi-generational dairies that were going out of business. And if they really started looking at their resource as a value added instead of a commodity fluid milk, then it could really change the direction of this economy. And that was inspired by Ellen Strauss, who is the mother of Albert, who owns the Strauss Family Creamery. She was instrumental in starting the Marin Agricultural Land Trust. And so it was through that kind of bigger effort of trying to save the farm so that you have the pasture, so that, you know, the cows have a place to graze and development pressures are off of the farms, that really made it possible for me and my business partner Peggy to think about, in, you know, trying to set up some way for us to make cheese and to inspire other dairies to do the same. So today there's 28 dairies that make cheese in Sonoma and Marin County. When we started there, we were the second in Marin, after Marin French. So what happened was that with the help of a lot of different energies, an appellation, much like the appellations of France, has been created in Marin and Sonoma that is really a cheese destination. So we're very proud to be a part of that.
Yeah, I think R.W. Apple, several years ago in the New York Times, called it the New Normandy, if I recall. Yeah. Well, Joyce, you have a wonderful quote in the book that opens it by Wallace Stegner. It's toward the front of the book. And it's about this state that we live in. And he says, it was in the Saturday Review in 1967, he says, like the rest of America, California is unformed, innovative, ahistorical, hedonistic, acquisitive, and energetic, only more so. And it hints a little at my first question for you, which is, why did the food revolution happen in California as opposed to New York City or Chicago or New Orleans?
Well, we were very lucky. First of all, because in one sense, we were the Wild West. We didn't have an old boys establishment in the restaurant business the way they did in Los Angeles and also in New York, where we're mostly European chefs running the restaurants like the military. And even now, some of the culinary schools call it boot camp, which I find disgusting, but there it is. So we had a lot of mom-and-pop restaurants in the Bay Area, and there was no reason why you couldn't try. It was, we love entrepreneurs. Instead of saying why, we would say why not. That was the point of view of California. And iconoclasts were admired. When many of us opened restaurants, I mean, I wasn't trained in the restaurant business. Annie learned on the job at Greens. Murad taught himself. We had so many people opening restaurants that had never gone to cooking school and had never worked in a restaurant before. But we believed we could do it, and we were crazy about food. This was a bunch of people, PhDs, people with graduate degrees, high IQs, well-traveled, well-read, standing for 12 hours peeling cases of tomatoes and being really happy. And you wonder about us. But food was very important. We had been inspired by our travels, by reading. We wanted to share our knowledge with people. And the Bay Area was the most generous place because in the East Coast, if you had a special farmer or purveyor, you never told. In the Bay Area, you ask people, where'd you get that cheese? And they give you the person's phone number. Where did you get this? And it was amazing, the sharing of information, the supporting people coming up in a business. We wanted to keep those farmers in business. As much business as we could send them, we would. The Greenleaf started putting out printouts to tell you about how things were grown and the history of the fruits and vegetables. Monterey Fish did a printout. In the beginning, we'd call them, they say, what's good, and they tell you. But now they give you where the fish came from, who the fisherman was, how it was caught. So education was very important. And California is the land of innovation. I mean, it's Apple, it's Google, it's the film industry, it's the music, it's everything. So nobody said, you can't do it. And they didn't say, you can't do it because you're a woman, and you can't do it because you didn't go to school. So this was a perfect place to be. Mm-hmm. That's why it happened.
Yeah, none of you have formal culinary training,
except
do you?
For Sue.
Except for Sue, going to City College.
Yes, I did go to City College.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, is
a very good school.
It's a great culinary program. Yeah. It really trains people to, it prepares them for life in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Good
mm-hmm.
training.
Yeah, it's interesting. In the book, there's a little passage about Chez Panisse at that time, talking about how, to some extent, there was no respect for technique because they were anti-culinary training. This was actually attributed to Barbara Tropp. She was talking about that, saying you couldn't possibly have a palate if you had technique. If you were technically good, there was something wrong with you. So it's interesting to... I wonder, Joyce, if you could comment on the chefs who started to bridge that divide a little bit.
Well, actually, I was there in that kitchen at that time where if we got people who were graduates of cooking school, no one had ever taught them to taste food. They knew how to hold a knife. They knew how to make, you know, certain basic sauces. They were very fast. They could chop, chop, chop. And they had never tasted anything. And we were a bunch of people, because we were food-obsessed and crazy, that would stand around tasting things. And so we were very wary of these guys that had come out of the professional schools. And you have to realize that when the CIA first opened in 1942, this was, or 45, whatever it was to train GIs to give them a career after the war. So for a lot of people, it was just a job. It wasn't a career. It wasn't a passion.
That's why it was called the CIA.
That's right. That's right. That's right. And thank you, Murad. So a lot of these guys we were getting, they weren't in love with food. It was a job. And we were all insane. And so we only wanted to hire people who told you where they traveled, what they ate, what they cooked at home, what books they read. When I interviewed chefs applying to work at Square One, I always asked them what they were reading, what they cooked for their friends, because I wanted to know something about their mouth. And sometimes you'd hire somebody who were perfectly capable, but they were in the wrong restaurant. I remember one guy, he was well-trained, but he never got it. He never could get the Mediterranean palate. We would make a sauce with him, and he could never repeat it because he didn't have it in his soul or whatever, or palate. So, and I think the thing that's so interesting is that also a lot of us have cooked together. There's a whole army of us that have all worked with each other, for each other, in each other's kitchens for years, and we've gotten used to tasting food together. And one of the wonderful things about going to the farmer's market is every Saturday morning, if I don't see Annie, I know she's got to be out camping somewhere because she's there every morning at 7:30. I see Murad there sometimes, now a little later. It used to be in the earlier wave. But I run into Lawrence. And what's so wonderful is to look at all the chefs with their carts and see what they bought and what are they going to do with it. And we have this community of palates. It's still very much palate-driven. And Los Angeles sort of laughs at us a little bit because they didn't get involved in the produce revolution until much later, till the 90s, even though their farmers market opened before ours, until Nancy Silverton started going to the market and telling other chefs about it. They were sort of oblivious because, again, this was more European old school and not as experimental.
Right. That's
so it was a big change.
Yeah.
Whereas here, we worked with our farmers and told them what we wanted. So we sort of led the way, and down there, the farmers market led the way for restaurants later on. It was completely mm-hmm. backwards.
The opposite way.
Yeah.
Taking a brief break to remind our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and we are discussing California's innovative contributions to the food we all eat. Our panelists are Joyce Goldstein, James Beard Award-winning chef, and food writer, whose new book is Inside the California Food Revolution, Annie Somerville, executive chef of Green's Restaurant in San Francisco, Murad Lalou, founder and owner of the Michelin-starred Aziza Restaurant in San Francisco, and Sue Conley, co-founder and co-owner of Cowgirl Creamery, and I'm Margot True, food editor of Sunset Magazine. Actually, I have a question for Annie from the audience. What role, and this will dovetail with a question I'd like to then follow up on, what role did Zen Center's Green Gulch Farm have on the early cultural revolution? And also I want to talk about a bit about the produce revolution that went on, but if you could address that question first, the larger cultural revolution of the time.
Well, Green Gulch was and is very much a part of that revolution. When we first opened in 1979, we were able to get produce, organic, sometimes a little buggy, not as beautiful, not as pristine as it is today, but very, very delicious produce from Green Gulch. Green Gulch is cool, coastal, and foggy out there in Muir Beach. So they were able to provide us with lettuces, all the leafy greens, potatoes, winter squash, a handful of more summery crops, which they do a small amount of. And so we were able to get that from Green Gulch during the growing season. And then in the winter season, when it gets pretty cold and pretty dark, and Green Gulch takes a break from farming to focus more on meditation, we were then left to our own devices, basically using commercially grown produce from the produce mart, because that's what was available at that time. So they've very much been a part of Greens and a part of Chez Panisse and a part of so many noteworthy restaurants in the Bay Area, and also a very important part of the Ferry Plaza Farmers Market when they're there much of the year, very much a favorite stand. So I will say that Green Gulch has played a big role. And also they have some of the best soil, ancient seabed, fed with lots of compost. They just had to remove lots and lots of rocks in the beginning, in the early days, just tons of stones, but it's a very fertile soil. And I can say that Greens has contributed to their soil by sending them lots of food scraps for their compost.
That's wonderful. Well, as everyone in this room knows, the whole farm-to-table movement really got going here. You know, now it's everywhere. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the produce revolution. And Annie, maybe you can start off by talking about this and how important it was to have this perfect circle happening of seeds to growers to distribution to the restaurants and the farmers markets, and how all those components needed to come together to make this actually happen. And what was it like when you started cooking? Did you ever cook in a place where you did not have this wonderful produce?
I will honestly say yes. I did not go to culinary school, as many of our panelists did not. Sue did. But I learned to cook at the Zen Center, in Zen Center's kitchens, serving family-style meals. And, you know, I think we didn't really think about at that time, we weren't thinking about where it came from. We did have a farm in Carmel Valley, which was an early organic farm, and we were able to get some produce from them, but mostly we were using the commercially grown produce. And I also want to say there's one person who is, I know, included in Joyce's book, Sabella Krauss. And Sabella really got things going by getting farmers connected to restaurants, getting farmers connected to chefs. And it, you know, we really take this all for granted now that, you know, you go to the farmer's market, you go to a restaurant, you read all these, the names of these farms on menus. That just wasn't the case then. So Sabella really spearheaded that project, and I would say a seminal event was held at Greens 30 years ago in August, and it was the Tasting of Summer Produce. There's a wonderful article on that in the August issue of Sunset, 30th anniversary of the Tasting of Summer Produce, bringing, you know, farmers from, I'll say, the Greater Bay region, extending into, you know, up north, probably representing a lot of the counties of the Bay Region. Solano, Contra Costa, you know, heading into the Central Valley, San Joaquin Valley, Santa Cruz, et cetera, bringing them all together to Greens for a family-style meal prepared by a big handful of chefs. And that at that time, that was a really revolutionary thing and was a sort of the beginning of a wonderful movement towards chefs being connected to farmers and producers, and also just the whole spearhead of farmers markets, the farmers markets we have today, which are so bountiful. We're so fortunate. That did not used to be the case.
True. And what was it like for you, Sue, at Betty's Diner, at the Ocean View Diner? Were you dealing with, you know, having to place wholesale orders and that kind of thing? Or?
Well, we used to shop down at the Oakland Produce Mart, the wholesale market, and we'd have to go at 2 in the morning, and we would see the other chefs there just picking through this very substandard produce to try to find a good head of lettuce. Yeah, it took a long time go ahead.
I just want to put in a plug for Bill Fujimoto at Monterey Market because his father had been shopping at the Oakland Market forever and built wonderful relationships with farmers, and finally said to them, I don't care if it's ugly, as long as it tastes good, I'll take it, I'll sell it. So a lot of the chefs used to go to Monterey Market. They got so depressed at the Oakland wholesale market that you went to Monterey Market and Bill would take you in the back room and there'd be delicious stuff. And Bill tasted everything, and he tasted everything raw so that he would know what to buy. And so he'd bite into raw eggplant or raw pumpkin and raw garlic, not a thrill. But he educated his palate and really was a part of this whole movement. He was on the board of the farmers market when it first opened. But he's somebody who we want to give credit to, and also to George Ann Brennan and her partner Charlotte Glenn of Le Marché Seeds, because where did the farmers get the seeds? George Ann and her partner set up a business just by making a call to Europe saying, we're a seed company in California. They didn't have an office. They didn't have a company. They met the owners of big seed company in Europe. They went over there. They brought back seeds. And then they went out to the farms to show some of the farmers how to grow this stuff because they'd never grown it before. So these were all such important people that if you ever see George Ann Brennan, say thank you. Bill Fujimoto, give him a hug, say thank you. These are people who changed our lives, and so we didn't have to go to a horrible produce market.
Well, Bill was one of the people that when you actually go to his market, he will actually talk about farmers.
Oh,
you don't just go to the market like Whole Foods and there are labels everywhere. He actually will tell you where the food came from. He has relationships. He will tell you that if you come back tomorrow, I might not have this product for you because we might not get it. And that's when, as a chef, you start to, you know, work with your menu in such a way that it will allow you to be flexible. You can't have the same items on the menu every day, mm-hmm. every week. And, you know, you get them from a big white truck called Cisco. you know. And honestly, that's what I did. I mean, when we first opened the restaurant, life was so much simpler. I'll make one phone call. I'll get my, you know, bleach with the carrots and the meat and everything in one delivery. And you realize that nothing tasted right. You know, not the carrots. The carrots did not taste like carrots. The apple did not taste like apples. You know, the lamb did not taste like lamb. As a matter of fact, everything tasted the same, like bad. So you start to realize, why does my food suck? And then, you know, the first thing that we were looking at is ingredients. Mm-hmm. You know, where is this stuff coming from? Why doesn't it? It looks beautiful. It's shiny. I mean, the apples were so shiny and beautiful. I mean, if I had an iPhone back then, you know, I would have taken so many beautiful shots of the apples. But they tasted like crap. And that's when people like Bill came in, and he helped us tremendously.
What kind of effect did that have on the way you cooked Moroccan food? Because that's always such you alluded to it when you were introducing yourself, but for someone like you who has such respect for the cooking of his home, how do you translate it to a new audience so that it has a lot of integrity, but it's still of its place? Because I know that you also switch techniques sometimes, and so
we've done it all. I mean, we have no boundaries, and I think that took a lot of guts to be able to do that. If you think about the Moroccan food and Moroccan cuisine, food means something different to Moroccans than it does to Americans, especially people in Northern California. In Morocco, food always evokes memories. So people want to eat food that reminds them of a moment in the past. So the best, you know, compliment you can get from somebody is if you eat something and you say, this reminds me of when I was 12 and my grandma used to make this. This is better than my aunt's chicken with lemons. This is as good as my mom's, you know, lentil soup. So it's always about the past. We don't give a damn about what's new, what's trendy. People don't care about that. The best chefs in Morocco are these old people that have been doing it for so many years. They're called dadas. You know, they've been doing the same recipes. There's no recipes. The notion of recipes, it does not exist in Morocco. It's a feel. Recipes are just guidelines. So when to go back to what Joyce was saying earlier, to get some, like, cook who tells you, just give me the recipe and I'll make it. Well, you won't. You won't make it because you have no idea. It's that whole thing with the palate. It's that whole thing with knowing what it needs. The tomatoes are not going to taste the same from day to day, let alone from place to place. When I was writing the cookbook, I was petrified that somebody from New York is going to call me up and say, hey, listen, that recipe did not work out. It's like, chances are it would not work out, you know? It's just the way it is. So food has to have a sense of place, as I said.
Basically, we all have to come cook with you, right, Moran?
Well, yeah, but like, cookbooks should be just inspirations.
Yeah.
You know, it should give you the inspiration to want to do something, but you got to own it. You got to own the recipes. You got to make it your own. You can't just cook somebody else's food. It's their life. I mean, they're putting their lives into that cookbook. You got to take it and make it your own.
Well, I have the perfect question from an audience member. How do you make couscous? They've said real couscous, but how does your couscous here in San Francisco differ from, say, how you would make it if you were in Morocco?
And it makes it the same way.
Yeah.
Well,
or does it differ?
Well, in Morocco, I had my great grandma, and she used to literally, I mean, couscous was the meal of the week. We eat it every Friday. We would eat couscous. It was one of those things that meant a lot more than just the dish. If you look at couscous, and this is the importance of food, you have somebody hand rolling it on Monday. Literally, hand rolling it on Monday. It's a skill that I don't know how the hell she got, but she could do it like nobody else. Everybody tried, everybody failed. Everybody knows it. So she would roll it on Monday, she would dry it on Tuesday, she would prep the rest of the stuff on Wednesday. She will start cooking it on Thursday, and we'll eat it on Friday.
Wow.
Every Friday. That's what we do. So as I think I was like 14 or 15, I was trying to be a smart ass, and I said, why do we have to have couscous on Fridays? And there was this silence in the room. Nobody talked for like the whole meal. And then when we were done, great-grandma looked at me, and she goes, if I don't make couscous for this family, I might as well be dead. And guess what? We had couscous every Friday, you know? And what it means is a lot. If you look at couscous, all those granules that are hand-rolled, they don't mean a thing alone. It's just a little grain, you know? It's a little insignificant. But when you eat it together, this big platter, and you take a lot of it, it's so tasty. Mm-hmm. And that's what brings the whole family together. You know, there's so much labor of love, and it's important. What I do here is we do the same thing. We have this Moroccan fellow who starts at 7 o'clock in the morning, and all he does is roll couscous. That's all he does. And he needs to have it done by 5 o'clock in the afternoon, half an hour before service. And he's been doing it for me now for 16 years. And to this day, he gets so sad because he would say something like, I'm going to fail you, chef. I'm going to fail you. I was like, what do you mean? He goes, I don't think I'm going to perfect this before I die. And he's like rolling it every day. I was like, don't worry, most Americans don't even know the difference. Say something like, you think? It's like, yes. But, you know, we do it the same way. But the way we cook, you know, most of our dishes, we always start with something traditional. But we try to make sense of it here. Mm. People here are different. You know, they're what their their sensibilities are different than what we have in Morocco. They want to eat a certain way. They want to know the farmers. They want to know where the food is coming from. They want to taste tomatoes when they eat tomatoes. They want to taste. It's so freaky because like we would like serve people strawberries and they would know where they're coming from. We don't even put farmers' names on the menu anymore. It's irrelevant at this point. Everybody knows where everything's coming from. So they literally would look at the strawberry and they will know that it's coming from Dirty Girl. I mean, we'll serve cheese. Like, oh, they know it's from Cowgirl. You know, there's no doubt about it. I mean, Jim is here. We serve his duck. People would taste the difference. People would know. That's how educated people hear about food, which is really cool.
Yeah, it's wonderful to cook for such a group. Sue, I wanted to go back a little bit to the rise of the artisan and the conditions in California that made that possible. And we've alluded, several of you have alluded to the freedom that exists here and the sort of entrepreneurial spirit. And I wondered, I know that with cheeses, it's often very liberating because you don't have to follow those same exact European models for cheese. Can you talk a little bit about the creation of, let's say, Red Hawk and how you came up with, what were you trying to make?
Well, I will preface this with I was not trained in cheese making. Okay, I'm a self-taught cheese maker. And so we started with just making fresh cheeses, and that's pretty straightforward. Any good cook could do that. And we made it in small batches. But we started to get interested in doing something a little more complex. And at the farmer's market, I met this nice young man named Fon Smit, and he was from the Netherlands. He was selling Dutch cheese for Mr. Bulk, who was in the valley. And he fell in love with one of his customers who talked him into staying in San Francisco when his apprenticeship was up. And so he asked me for a job, and he was a dairy scientist. Though he wasn't a great cheesemaker, he knew much more than I did about the science of cheesemaking. And, of course, this helps, unlike the improvisation in a kitchen, it helps to make a consistent product if you do use some science in cheesemaking. So I said, let's make something really soft and beautiful like a Saint André that everybody loves at a party, little, you know, triple cream with white fluffy mold on the outside, and that should be a good seller. And he said, let's make a Gouda. Because, actually, that was the only cheese he knew how to make. That's what he knows. So we got a Gouda recipe, and we put some cream in, and we lightened up on the cooking and lightened up on the stirring, and we increased the humidity in the aging room, and over time it got softer and softer and creamier and more delicious, and the white mold grew. And so that was our first cheese, Mount Tam. But one day the mold didn't grow. It just was a bald little bowling ball in there. And so I said, I know, Fonce, I'll just spray more of the candidum on the rind and it'll grow, it'll be great. And instead, 2 days later, it just had killed everything, and it was just this kind of rubbery looking rind. And so I put it in the back of the aging room for another month, and Kate Arding, who was running the cheese counter, pulled it out by accident and opened the lid to this little tub I had it in and cut it open, which I would have been afraid to do. But she cut it open and tasted it and said, Sue, Fonce, this is the best cheese you've ever made. You got to come in here. Because what we did was we killed that white mold and encouraged another bacteria, Bacterium linen, which you see on Taleggio and some of those stinky rind cheeses. And because it was a covered box, it was a higher humidity. And so we learned to repeat that.
And that I'm going to tweet after this that Red Hawk is a mistake.
It's a mistake.
Delicious mistake.
And it's the one, you know, it is our best cheese in that it's the most complex. And, you know, we learned how to control all of those variables and to make it really delicious every time. So, yeah, that's what Americans get to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then here's a sort of a side question from an audience member. Why is so much commercially available cheese in America less than great, even today? What is responsible for that?
You know, I'm not going to... cheese, commodity cheese, is a healthy and nutritious food.
Taxes.
Very tactful.
Very tactful. Thank you.
However, it is not, you know, the number one main goal in that cheese is to make it affordable, to make it inexpensive. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying that that's a bad goal, but it's not the goal of small production cheesemakers who are looking to get the most out of that milk that's from, in our case, a single herd from a certain pasture. From, you know, mm-hmm. It's not the goal that we're trying to attain.
Mm-hmm. That is such a good answer.
She's a
yeah, but this reminds me of when Steve Sullivan first started making bread, and when he went to open Acme, he needed to hire bakers, and all these people came to apply for work. And they only knew how to run machines. They had never hand-formed bread. He had to re-teach people how to make bread by hand. So a lot of our artisans did this. I mean, Paul Bertoli first making his sausage and prosciutto, a lot of trial and error. There weren't any books, you know. You had to go to Italy and taste it and watch and hope somebody would teach you. And usually you just picked it up and then came here and messed around with it until you got it. And I think this happened with so many of the things that we were doing. People were willing to put in the time and make mistakes and didn't feel bad about it because you get Red Hawk, you see. That's
yeah,
what happens.
That's right. And then sometimes this lack of training resulted in some kind of less than wonderful things like bad fusion cooking. Remember
oh,
well. That
oh,
era?
Oh, yes, we all, the 90s.
The 90s. The trough of the 90s.
Yeah.
But at Square One, you were doing what in your book you call eclectic cuisine. Can you talk a little
yeah.
bit about that? Because that was often confused, eclectic with fusion.
Well, the press was very confused. What we did is we cooked food from different countries, but we didn't mush them all together. So if we had a Greek dish, it was Greek, and it had Greek vegetables and a Greek grain. If we did a Moroccan dish, pardon me, Morag, but I did do a few, they were consistent. If we had something Spanish, if it was French, if it was Italian. So we could have in our restaurant multiple foods from different countries, but they were infused. Fusion cooking really started mostly in Southern California. Wolfgang Puck, I think, was the first person to sort of say, well, why am I cooking only this French food I'm eating in Chinatown? And he started messing around with it. And on the Spago menu, all of a sudden, squab with Chinese five spice appeared on the menu. And he started experimenting with Asian ingredients. And L.A. had many more, I want to say, multicultural ethnic markets that enabled chefs to eat out widely and learn a lot more about different cultures. The Bay Area was much more of a Mediterranean place. We sort of stayed in the Mediterranean. And I think we didn't experiment as much, but there were some restaurants that only cooked French food or only cooked Italian food. That's a traditional way. Then we had eclectic menus. And down in L.A., Mary Sue and Susan at City Restaurant also had an eclectic menu. Susan went to India. The next thing you know, their French menu had Indian dishes. And then Mary Sue went to Thailand. And the next thing you know, you had Thai food. But I think the fusion stuff started in the 90s. And some of it was sensitively done. And then we got to the period where it was just a mess. 42 ingredients on a plate, none of them related, 12 different cultures. I mean, you got things that you thought, oh, my God. And fortunately, that stopped. And what's happening now in its grown-up form is something where people who have grown up in one culture, I'll give you an example of Roy Choi in L.A., who is Korean, who grew up eating Mexican food all of his life. He's in L.A., and so if he does a Korean taco, he knows what a taco is, and he knows what Korean flavors are, and he can do it. That's not fusion. It is, but it's a grown-up fusion. It's not just applying a flavor at the last minute and saying, oh, I think I'll put a little ginger in my osobuco. No, that's not what it is. It's really understanding the food of different cultures and using them in a sensitive way where the flavors work. That doesn't mean everybody doing it is successful, but I think that's a movement that really started in California and is now happening all over the country. If you read menus anywhere, you will see a lot of what I would call multicultural cooking taking place. Some of it really well done, quite delicious. And there'll always be, you know, some guys or girls doing stuff that they don't really understand the flavors, and some of it will be messy, but it's much better than what was happening in the 90s. It's a big improvement.
So it's like what Roy is doing is personal.
Mm-hmm.
He is true to himself.
Yeah.
He grew up in L.A. He's Korean, so he's exposed to both flavors.
And then he knows.
And he was able to marry the two beautifully.
Yeah.
And I think he's doing a great job,
Yeah.
a really great job.
So that's organic fusion. That's the real deal.
Mm-hmm. A question from the audience. As a Californian farmer who is not in a farmer's market, this has to go goes back to the produce revolution, what's the best way to introduce my produce to you?
Oh.
Annie, would you like to take that on?
Well, I am used to meeting people at the farmer's market. However, come on into the restaurant, you know, call up ahead of time and say, you know, I'm a farmer and I'm growing whatever crops it is that you have to offer, and I'd love to meet you and I'd love to have you taste what I have, what it is that I grow.
And that's kind of the way it's been done for decades mm-hmm. now, right? And this kind of informal.
Yeah. And I'll also say, I think we all have that very informal relationship with and absolute 100% respect for the people who produce this food, because it is so much work to farm, to make cheese, to produce olive oil, to make wine, all of it, to, you know, it's just, it's a tremendous, it's a lot of work to run a restaurant, and then it's even more work, I think, to do, to be a producer. So we just have a wonderful informal relationship with people and welcome them to come in, and so that's my answer.
Then we have what will probably be our final question from the audience. And by the way, thank you so much for all the questions you've been sending up. It's been hard to choose from, but I'm going to pick this one because it seems quite germane. Here we are at the sort of a very good place in the California food revolution, and yet there's often quite a lot of talk about the disparity between those who can afford the good food, quote-unquote, and those who cannot. And the question is, in a nation and state with increasing income inequality, is the California food revolution destined to be a preserve of only those with means?
This goes back to what Sue was talking about as far as her cheese, you know, compared to commercial cheeses. When I travel, one of the things that I hear a lot is that what's taking place in California is very elitist. Only the rich people can afford food that we produce. People who are making $7 an hour could not possibly afford to go to the farmer's market at the Ferry Building, park for $20, and go shop for a couple hours and end up putting down like $300, you know, buying wild arugula for $12 a pound. You know, it's a natural progression in a way. These things have to happen. And this ties into the point that Annie was making, where new farmers have to come in. Farming used to be really hard, and in a way that farmers were not able to make a living. Now there are some farmers who are making a good living, and they're, you know, farming has become lucrative. But that will attract other farmers. There is a problem with loyalty. I am extremely loyal to those farmers. It's really hard for somebody to come and try to sell me something that I'm getting from somebody else. It has to be cheaper, and that will bring the prices down. So that might be just a natural progression, and it will take some time before we get there. But we can't even think about getting there if we don't go through this.
Mm.
Farmers have to make money. They have to be willing to do it. The age of a farmer is going down a little bit. So it used to be like 68 years old of the average farmer. Now it's going down to like 55 or something like that. And there are a lot, if you go to the farmer's market, there are a lot of farmers who are young. They're in their 20s and 30s. They don't want to be, you know, Facebookers or working for Twitter or Google or anything like that. They don't want to be the G kind of generation. They just want to farm and they care, but they still want to have a life. they still care about their bodies, they care about their social lives, you know, they tweet, you know, they do all the things that other people do. But this is just natural progression. I don't think it's elitist. I think it's necessary, and it's just part of life.
And I do think that we've been really focused on the stability of those farmers and the people who work on farms and work as artisans and producers. Our focus has been on stabilizing that rural economy, making sure people are getting paid properly and they have health insurance. And so we're working on that end of the spectrum, and the consumer end, I agree, should come along.
I also think that there are other venues now where people can eat less expensively. I think that there's the phenomenon of the pop-up restaurant, which happens every once in a while, or food trucks. This is not necessarily a sit-down gourmet experience, but it does get people to taste new foods in a less expensive format. I also think part of the problem is that people have forgotten how to cook at home, and that means that they're dependent on eating out a lot more, whereas if they just went even to the Safeway or any market and got some ingredients and cooked at home, they would eat a lot better than eating the pre-prepared stuff and a lot of the fast food, which is cheap for a reason because it's garbage. And you could cook for yourself a lot more reasonably. But I don't know what it's going to take to get people back in the kitchen. This is the thing that depresses the hell out of me. I know that there's a whole couple of generations that have grown up with nobody cooking at home to even show them how. And we've taken it out of our schools. When I went to school, we had home ec, hardly gourmet cooking, but we did learn how to put a couple of basic things on the table. And, you know, a lot of these kids watching TV and they think that it's fun and this is a glamorous profession, they have no idea what this work is. Being in a restaurant is hard work. Being a farmer is hard work. Raising animals is hard work. And we do want to support these people. We never want them to go out of business. But the home cook has a responsibility, too. We can't do it all for you. You have to do something, too. We have to get you back in the kitchen. And if somebody would please tell us how, I will write that book.
Thank you.
Yes.
I totally disagree with you. I think everybody should go out to restaurants and eat.
Well, unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where we only have time for one last question. And, of course, it has to be what's next. Where will the California food revolution take us in the next 5 years? And I'd love to start with Sue and kind of just a comment or two.
Well, in the world of cheese, as I stated earlier, we are getting more cheesemakers on board, and they're small. They're farmstead on their own dairies primarily. We are also raising the bar on our professionalism. Both we're increasing education for cheesemakers, and we have a new certificate that's similar to a sommelier for cheesemongers, a cheese professional certificate. We're training the FDA how to inspect small producers. That's a huge effort in our American Cheese Society. And I think that there's more and more interest. As Murad said, there's a lot of young farmers and people moving to places like Point Reyes Station. We couldn't find anybody who wanted to work in our creamery initially, and now they're knocking on the door. They're graduates of Cal Poly. They want to make cheese. They want to cook in a restaurant that is connected to a farmer. So yeah, things are, I think, looking up.
That's great.
I'm going to look at it from a different perspective. I think a lot of people, and including myself, we've been talking all these years since I started cooking about sustainable produce, sustainable meats, sustainable, you know, everything. Nobody has talked about sustainable labor. And that is the biggest challenge that we have right now. We have cooks that are making $11, $12 an hour. That's all we can give them. We have servers that are making $300, $400 a night. And I think until we decide to pay a fair price for the food in restaurants, none of that's going to change. And I think we need to start talking about sustainable labor. That conversation needs to start now.
And on the farms, too, no?
Absolutely.
Health,
I mean, but, you know, it's just like there's this gulf, this discrepancy between what the front of the house makes and what the rest of the world makes compared to cooks. And really, it's not that the restaurants are greedy or they don't pay well because people are in the back of the house. It's just that is all we can pay. And until people are willing to pay an extra $2 or $3 per dish, we're not going to be able to do anything about it. And it's going to affect the way people eat because a lot of cooks right now, they move into the front of the house or they're leaving the state. They're leaving the state. They're going back home. They come here for a year. They put in their time. They learn and they go back. If we don't do anything about it, we will all be eating pizzas and burgers. I swear to you.
Yeah, it's really true. And Annie, how about you?
Well, I'm very optimistic that more and more people are eating more and more vegetables. And, you know, there are vegetables that we used to have to hide on the menu, and we don't have to do that anymore. So, and also, I just want to say that I'm so grateful to the farmers and the producers who grow really good food. And, you know, someone recently asked me, they said, well, isn't it awfully expensive to shop at a farmer's market? And I said, well, yes, but many of us have choices about how to spend our money and what money we have. And I make the choice to buy really good kale, buy great lettuce, buy a good piece of cheese, get some good olive oil, and enjoy those ingredients. And also, I feel that one of the great benefits of eating this good food is good health. And if you think of it as a savings, by eating well and eating reasonably and well and eating what's in season, fresh and good, and also supporting some good people along the way, it's good for your health and you'll save some money on medical bills.
Okay, I have a few small predictions. I think the labor issue is a huge one. I was talking to Amaral the other day, and she can't open at night because she can't find enough cooks to hire.
This is Amaral Schwertner of Boulette's Larder.
Right. And that's a sad story. This is happening all over the country. In big cities, the line cooks are leaving. A lot of women are leaving the kitchen business as far as restaurants. They're going into other fields, thank God. They are becoming cheesemakers and bakers and sommeliers and working the front of the house. But they are trying for better balance in their lives, and women seem to be very entrepreneurial these days and do not want to work on the line. I think we're going to see also casual, really casual places like bars having really good chefs all of a sudden. This is something I'm noticing. People who've worked, like the guy Isaac Miller at Maven, worked with David Kinch. He's cooking at a bar, pairing food for cocktails, and doing a beautiful job. And the food is reasonably priced. They're making their money on the booze. Nobody seems to complain about spending $15 for a cocktail, by the way. And yet they're going to bitch about a plate of pasta or a vegetable dish. So
you said bitch.
I did. I'm sorry. Oh, Murad, I've broken my oath. I'm so bad. Pardon me. Pardon my mouth. But I think the thing is there are going to be other young people who are trained in good places who realize that some of these very fancy places are not sustainable for them, and that they will work in smaller kitchens, in much more casual venues. I'm just starting to see more of it now. I think we're on the brink of big change. I think the whole tipping service charge system has to be addressed. Pete Wells broached this in the Times this week. Americans have got to say, I'm going to tip what I like, and then go to Europe and there's a service charge and nobody sits and complains. We have to break some patterns, too. We had a revolution about food. Maybe we need to have a revolution about service and how we run our restaurants and realize that we're all in it together. We want our farmers to have health insurance and earn a living. We want our line cooks not to have six people in a one-bedroom apartment while they're learning. We don't want people going into debt $40,000 a year in cooking school when maybe they could apprentice and learn on the job. There's nothing wrong with learning on the job. You do very well. I just think the whole value system is a little screwed up, and I think Annie put her finger on it. I mean, you choose to spend your money. You can You can go to a tanning salon. You can buy $15 drinks. You can do all sorts of new iPhones and whatever. But food is very important, and we as a country spend less on food than any other nation. And that says something about us, and that's why that damn Cisco truck is out there. Because most people don't care. We care, and Northern California cares especially. And if it looks like we're a small group right now, it's happening all over the country. So we have some responsibility here, and we do have to make changes in many other aspects of it.
Well, I think that's a perfect place to start, because this whole revolution was driven by values and understanding the primary importance of food in every aspect of life and how it can make life better. And obviously, there's still work to be done. So thank you very much. Thanks to Joyce Goldstein, James Beard award-winning chef and food writer, whose new book is Inside the California Food Revolution, Annie Somerville, executive chef of Green's Restaurant in San Francisco, Murad Lalou, founder and owner of Aziza Restaurant in San Francisco, and Sue Conley, co-founder and co-owner of Cowgirl Creamery. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the internet. This program has been part of the club's Food Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. It has also been held in association with the Commonwealth Club's Bay Gourmet Forum. And I want to remind everyone here that copies of Joyce Goldstein's new book, Inside the California Food Revolution, are for sale in the lobby, as are books by all of us sitting here in front of you, and we'll all be pleased to sign copies outside this room right now. We appreciate your letting our panelists make their way to the signing tables. I'm Margot True, food editor of Sunset Magazine, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.